This is the last day of this July 2016 7-day session. And we'll take up a koan today. This is from the Mumon Kan, number 42. A woman comes out of samadhi. And here's the case. Once in ancient times, Manjusri came to a place where many Buddhas had assembled with the world-honored one. When he arrived there, the Buddhas had all returned to their original dwelling place. Only a young woman remained sitting in samadhi near the Buddha's seat. Manjusri asked the Buddha, "How is it that this woman is so close to your seat and I cannot be?" The Buddha said to Manjusri, "You may bring this woman out of her deep meditation and ask her yourself." Manjusri walked around her three times, snapped his fingers once, then took her up to the Brahma heaven and exerted all his supernatural powers, but could not bring her out of her samadhi. The world-honored one said, "Even 100,000 Manjusris could not get her out of her deep condition. But down below, past 1,200 million lands, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is a bodhisattva named Momyo. He will be able to arouse her from her samadhi." Instantly, the bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and bowed to the world-honored one, who gave him the order. Momyo then went over to the woman and snapped his fingers once, and at this, she came out of her samadhi. This koan, most koans are dialogues or stories from ancient China, dialogues between actual Chinese masters and monks. This one is one of the exceptions. It's from a myth in a Chinese sutra that was published in 300 AD. Zen has no problem using myths and even fairy tales as koans, because it's the actual historical veracity of the koan is unimportant. Each koan is a vehicle for coming to understand the Dharma. And so it can be something like this from ancient India. Manjusri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, Manjusri himself, the scholars say, didn't appear on the scene in Buddhist literature until about the year 400. There are those who say that Manjusri was a flesh and blood disciple of the Buddha. But if so, then they say he wasn't, we don't hear about him until the sutra from some 800 years later. I'm going to read a little bit here about Manjusri. The name literally means he who is noble and gentle. He's one of the leading figures in the Buddhist pantheon, one of the leading bodhisattvas. I guess there are many, 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 many different bodhisattvas in Buddhist teaching, but there are only half a dozen who are the real stars, and Manjushri is one. If you want to learn more about bodhisattvas, there's a terrific book called Faces of Compassion. The original title of the book was Bodhisattva Archetypes, and now it's out as Faces of Compassion. And in it, the author goes through Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, or Guanyin, Kanon, and Samantabhadra, the Bodhisattva of Action, and that really gives a very extensive outline of each one, and then does something really cool. He takes people from history, even some contemporary figures, but also from fairly recent history, and as examples of each of these bodhisattva archetypes. Usually Manjushri is in Buddhist statuary, iconography, is shown with a sword, wielding the sword, the delusion-cutting sword, and or with a sutra, usually about the level of the head, in a lotus, a lotus blossom, and the sutras, when it is there, is the book of the Prajnaparamita. So you could say, in a way, Manjushri is a symbol of prajna, which in Zen we normally think of as wisdom, but it can also, in other traditions, it can be thought of more prajna as knowledge. So the knowledge part is shown by the sutra, the wisdom by the sword, the sword of mu, the sword that cuts in one. Wait until a little later to read the commentary and verse that follows the case. But back to the case. Once in ancient times, Manjushri came to a place where many Buddhas had assembled with the world-honored one. When we say the Buddha, we're referring to our historical Buddha, the Buddha Shakyamuni, who lived in India about 2,500 years ago. But according to Buddhist cosmology, Shakyamuni is only the most recent of a whole beginningless lineage of fully enlightened ones. In our ancestral line, we start with the seven Buddhas that precede Shakyamuni, just as a seven just being a way of indicating that they go way, way, way back. And this, the next sentence is very important. When he got there, that is Manjushri, the Buddhas had all returned to their original dwelling place. Well, where's that? And why did they leave as soon as he got there? This is a key point in unlocking this koan. Only a young woman remained sitting in samadhi near the Buddha's seat. Samadhi is a term we use from time to time. It's a rich term, very useful for those of us who do the actual practice of meditation. It's a Sanskrit word that literally means to establish or make firm. That's the etymology of it. It's a state of consciousness in which subject and object merge. The one experiencing the object and the object become one. This is the precondition for awakening. And it requires being free of thoughts. Free meaning unattached to thoughts. There are different degrees of samadhi. A light samadhi is one thing, and a deep samadhi is something else. Here we are to infer that this young woman is in a deep samadhi. It's important in understanding this koan to take it from its own historical context. Manjushri asked the Buddha, how is it that this woman is so close to your seat and I cannot be? In ancient India, as in so many ancient cultures and even contemporary cultures, a woman's place was subservient to a man's. And then, in addition, it's a young woman, and here too, in ancient cultures especially, a young person would be not as revered as an older person. So here, this is a young woman who's so close to the Buddha's seat. It's maybe a little hard for us as Americans to appreciate the significance of this hierarchy and as it plays out in seating. I always had heard that the Vietnam War treaty was delayed quite a bit because the parties involved in it, the various diplomats and others, had the hardest time coming up with the seating arrangement at the peace table. I got a little bit of this when I was in Japan, and when we would have our very infrequent meetings of the residents with the Roshi, I was astonished at how much time he took to get us all in the right order, with him at the head, of course, and then the most senior next to him, and then on down to the most junior. And this always left the Japanese pulling their hair out, because they didn't know what to do with us as Westerners. We may have spent 20 years practicing here, but they didn't know what that meant exactly, and so they didn't know where to put us in the order. So here we see it again. She's sitting right next to the Buddha. So we have to take it in its own terms, that is, the historical terms of the subservience of women. The Buddha says to Manjushri, well, bring this woman out of her deep meditation and ask her yourself. So Manjushri walked her around her three times, snapped his fingers once, and took her up to the Brahma heaven and exerted all his supernatural powers, but still couldn't bring her out of her samadhi. So he did everything within his power to get her out, and failed. And then the World Honored One, who no doubt knew the Manjushri would fail, said even 100,000 Manjushris could not get her out of her deep condition. But now, listen, down below, past 1,200 million lands, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges River, there is a bodhisattva named Momyo. He will be able to arouse her from her samadhi. Now, Momyo enters the stage. And Momyo, we are to understand, is a bodhisattva in the early stages of practice. Not one of the big-name bodhisattvas that we know of, but a low-ranking one who's just getting going as a bodhisattva. So right away, the bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and bowed to the World-Honored One who gave him the order. And then Momyo went over to the woman, snapped his fingers once, and at this she came out of her samadhi. So what makes this a koan is that the great Manjushri, who, according to myth, was the teacher of seven Buddhas, Manjushri couldn't do this, and the lowly Momyo could. How so? There are a lot of little things one could stumble over in this koan if you were too literal-minded. Samadhi itself, one of the classic definitions of samadhi is a state of illuminated awareness. Bright stillness. Deep, bright stillness. Don't normally think of samadhi as any kind of state of unconsciousness that you would have to be shaken out of. But apparently in the deepest kinds of samadhi this can happen. The reason we do talk about samadhi as much as we do is because it is, again, it's the precondition for awakening, and it's what confirms the indivisibility of all existences. And once we have experienced this indivisibility, then our innate compassion is more likely to be liberated and more likely to function. We all have in our true nature, we all have this compassion as an element of our true nature, but it is, there's a great deal of difference between among people and how much it flows, how much it actually functions for us. I talked earlier in Sesshin about the practice of loving-kindness, metta-meditation, where you try to radiate loving-kindness. That's the practice, and how that's different from the traditional Zen practice, in which you're not trying to create a state, but that is the side effect, that's the byproduct of a state of absolute unity. There's a story that illustrates this from this collection called Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, Parables of the Spiritual Path from Around the World, edited by Christina Feldman and Jack Kornfield. It goes like this. A young man who had a bitter disappointment in life went to a remote monastery and said to the abbot, "I'm disillusioned with life, and I wish to attain enlightenment to be freed from these sufferings. But I have no capacity for sticking long in anything. I could never do long years of meditation and study and austerity. I should relapse and be drawn back to the world again, painful though I know it to be. Is there any short way for people like me?" "There is," said the abbot, "if you are really determined." And the abbot asked him, what have you studied in your life? What have you concentrated on most in your life?" And the fellow said, "Why, nothing really. We were rich and I did not have to work. But, you know, I suppose the thing I was really interested in was chess. I spent most of my time at that." The abbot thought for a moment and then said to his attendant, "Call such and such a monk and tell him to bring his chessboard and men. So the monk came with the board, and the abbot set up the men on the board. He sent for a sword and showed it to the two players. "Oh, monk," he said. And now he's not talking to the guy who we were just talking about who came, but he's talking to one of his own monks. He said, "You have vowed obedience to me as your abbot, and now I require it of you. You will play a game of chess with this young man, and if you lose, I shall cut off your head with this sword. But I promise you that you will be reborn in paradise. If you win, I'll cut off the head of this man. Chess is the only thing he has ever tried hard at, and if he loses, he deserves to lose his head also." They looked at the abbot's face, and they saw that he meant it. He would cut off the head of the loser. So the two began to play. With the opening moves, the youth felt the sweat trickling down to his heels as he played for his life. The chessboard became the whole world. He was entirely concentrated on it. He was in a samadhi. At first he had somewhat the worst of it, but then the monk, made an inferior move and he seized his chance to launch a strong attack. As his opponent's position crumbled, he stole a glance at him. He saw a face of intelligence and sincerity, worn with years of austerity and effort. He thought of his own worthless life and a wave of compassion came over him. So he deliberately made a blunder and then another, ruining his position and leaving himself defenseless. And at that, the abbot leaned forward and upset the board, turned it over. The two contestants were flabbergasted. The abbot said, "There is no winner and no loser. There is no head to fall here. Only two things are required." And he turned to the young man and said, "Complete concentration and compassion. You have today learned them both. You were completely concentrated on the game, but then in that concentration, you could feel compassion and sacrifice your life for it. Now stay here for a few months and pursue our training in this spirit, and your enlightenment is sure." If you stick with Zen practice long enough, and especially if you can manage to come to Sesshin, where we do so much sitting, and where you're most likely to reach deep states of concentration, you will, sooner rather than later, you will experience what compassion really is. And it's not by trying to be compassionate, or trying to feel compassionate. It just is an outgrowth of deep concentration. When we see that there is no other apart from ourself, when we see everything as one, then it's natural that we stir this compassion that has always been part of our nature. So the logical-minded people would say, "Well, wait a minute, Manjusri must have had all kinds of states of concentration, samadhi. So how come he couldn't step forward and help this woman?" But it misses the point. These are just figures that are used to dramatize the relationship between the Buddha, Manjusri, Momyo, and the dynamics of why Manjusri couldn't wake her and Momyo could. We'll turn to the commentary. "Old Shakya put on a clumsy play, no better than a child. Now tell me, Manjusri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he bring the woman out of her samadhi?" By the way, the logical-minded might say, "Why would you want to bring her out of her samadhi? Knock herself out. Momyo is a bodhisattva of the initial stage. How could he do so? If you can firmly grasp this point, then for you this busy life of karma and discrimination will be the life of the dragon samadhi, that is, supreme satori." Well, he just here, Mumon, who compiled these koans in the Mumonkan, is just making it, spelling it out for us, what the contradiction is here. And then Mumon's verse. "One could bring her out, the other could not. Both of them are free. A god mask, a devil mask, the failure is wonderful indeed." This is a verse that can be mined more than most other verses in the Mumonkan. There's a lot in here. One could bring her out, the other could not. Both of them are free. How so? How is Manjushri free when he couldn't do what Momyo did? What kind of freedom is Mumon talking about here? One of the cardinal rules of koans is not to take them literally. It forces us to work with words and the inadequacy of words, the limitations of words, and to see what experience or what reality they're pointing to in their own way. Both of them are free. God mask, a devil mask. The failure is wonderful indeed. How, leaving aside the specifics of the koan, how can it be that a failure could be wonderful? Most people can understand that there's some instrumental value in failure. That when we fail at something, it can be good for our development. Especially if there's pride, if we have pride, then failure can sand off some of that pride and enable us to reach a deeper experience of ourselves and the world. But this isn't the essential failure that we can understand in this drama. Aside from whatever usefulness there may be in failing at something, in terms of future development and character development, even we could say, what would be wonderful about failure? What would be wonderful about anything? Anything that we relegate and commonly relegate as bad or undesirable. This discriminating of good and bad is the work of the smallest part of the mind, but one that gets a lot of exercise, this discriminating consciousness, the mind that classifies and categorizes. What's beyond that? When we stick to something long enough, and finally turn things around and succeed, to use a word that's very limited, succeed at something, then sometimes we can look back and appreciate the failure or the string of failures that led up to that. We come to understand that there was something just perfect about that failure, those failures. And then if we do get to that point where, let's say, we do come to awakening, we will sooner or later from there see that there is no ultimate success or failure. It's an endless process. practice is an endless process of becoming, growing, evolving. Zen Master Dogen famously said that practice is a process of continuous failure. And we can confirm that after awakening too. There is no state of perfection. It's an ongoing process of working, developing, refining. There is this line that we make in the air. We call it, before the line dividing enlightenment and non-enlightenment. But what really is it? Given that we are all innately enlightened, it's like a national border. Let's say two very similar countries, like the United States and Canada, where you cross the border, you go through immigration and customs, you cross the border, and how different is it? You look around, the scenery, the trees, the vegetation, the fields. How different is it? Going either way, from here to there or there to here. And yet, there are these distinctions that we make that have some purpose, some value to them, and we call one Canada and one the United States. So we can't just say there's no difference. There is a difference. Try smuggling drugs across the border and getting caught doing that. There's a distinction. We can't say there's just that they're completely different either. If we persevere long enough, we come to find for ourselves how they're the same and how they're different. As long as they don't let up. Our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. Endless blind passions, I vow to uproot. Dharma gaze beyond measure, I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to manage the perfect way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attend.